In 1899, Ali Rowbottom's great-great-great-uncle bought the patent to Jell-O from its inventor for $450. The sale turned out to be one of the most profitable business deals in American history. He sold the patent 26 years later for $67 million, and generations of his descendants enjoyed immense wealth and privilege. But the family was haunted by suicides, cancer, mysterious illnesses, and alcoholism, afflictions that came to be known as the Jell-O Curse. In her new book, Jell-O Girls, Ali Rowbottom weaves together her own family history with the story of a quintessential American dessert. It's published by Little Brown & Company, and I'm happy to welcome Ali to our show.
Thank you for having me.
So your history focuses on the lives of your grandmother, Midge, and your mother, Mary. Why did you want to tell the stories of the Jell-O Girls?
It was a story that's been in my family, particularly in my mother's life, for a really long time. And she was quite obsessed with telling her story, even as she got sick and eventually died. So I felt that it was imperative for me to continue telling the story where she left off, both for her sake and just for mine as well. I think for my mother, the idea of the curse was really linked to her own inability as a child to speak and to really express her trauma. And so it was imperative as an adult to release that trauma.
And it was interesting to discover that your mother began writing or at least collecting notes for memoir before she died. In that sense, it felt like you've sort of inherited this book in every sense of the word. Did you feel it was an obligation to finish it?
I wouldn't say I felt it was an obligation, but it was definitely something that I wanted to do. I think my mom worked on her memoir for most of my life, actually. She was obsessed with it. But she struggled to really tell the story in a way that I think other people would find compelling. And she knew that about it. And I did too. And I thought, oh, maybe I could give it a try. And wouldn't that be cool to honor her in that way? I think she'd be really happy about it.
Your great-great-great uncle purchased the Jell-O business in 1899 for $450, as I said, and sold it for $67 million 26 years later. Is your family still connected to the company in any way?
No. The Jell-O company was sold to Postum, what was Postum at the time, in 1925. And so since then, we've been only inheritors of money.
Were you aware of this story and your inheritance growing up?
Somewhat. Eventually, yes, very clearly, but not until I was around six or seven, maybe a little older. It was in the air in my mother's studio in particular. She had a lot of Jell-O paraphernalia, and she would tell me about it, but I didn't understand until later.
And you also grew up in the town of Leroy, New York, where the family home and factory is located, right?
My mom did. No, okay. I did not, yeah.
So what happened to the Jell-O factory in Leroy?
The Jell-O factory in Leroy still stands, but it's mostly vacant. There's sort of a couple different office spaces that are sort of come and go from it, but last time I visited, it was mostly vacant. You can sort of peer in the window and see dusty remnants and sort of old artifacts, but that's about it. The windows are broken. Sometimes it's used for paintball, I think, for the local kids.
So what was your grandmother Midge's career before she married your grandfather Bob?
Midge was a journalist. She wrote for a paper in Honolulu for a time, and then later a little bit for the Leroy, New York paper, but she was an aspiring writer.
So how do you think having to give up her career, have children, and become a housewife affected her?
I think it was hard. She was a private person, so it's sort of hard to tell, but I had in addition to my mother's memoir, I inherited a lot of Midge's letters to her mother and to other people as well. And I think it was really hard for her to have children and to give up, in some regards, her writing life. It almost wasn't proper for her to continue to write and be a mother and sort of fulfill her societal obligations, especially after she and her husband, Bob, moved back to Leroy, where the family was sort of a big presence.
And she passed when your mother was quite young.
Yes, 14. My mom was 14 when her mother died of cancer, you know, which really marked my mother, I think. And my mom's life as an adult was so, so colored by her own loss and her grief and trauma. So I grew up around that as well. And now, having lost my own mother, I understand where she was coming from in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it captures the fact that this book really covers so much ground. I mean, at first glance, subject matter can appear lighthearted and extremely immediate in that way, but it's quite dark at turns and quite something to wrestle with.
Absolutely. I mean, something that I say in the book, and I think about this a lot, but my mom was very concerned with letting me know that there was always a dark side to the light, and I think particularly when it comes to the portions of the book that deal with Jell-O's marketing and how those marketing campaigns affected women, I think it's important to look at them and also, you know, through a larger lens, society in general and capitalism in general, with that understanding that what is sold to us as lightness is oftentimes quite dark.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Ali Rowbottom about her book, Jell-O Girls, A Family History, published by Little Brown & Company. I want to talk about the Jell-O marketing campaigns. You weave in details of 100 years of Jell-O marketing campaigns into your own family history. What did you want to highlight with these campaigns, many of which seem so ridiculous and outdated now, right?
They're so fun to research and sort check out. I had a ball with it. I think I wanted to highlight Jell-O's changing approaches to women's societal roles and how those approaches both coincided with and at times butted heads with the American feminist movement.
Did any of your family members have a hand in creating the Jell-O marketing campaigns? Or
initially, Ernest Woodward, who my great-great-aunt married, he was quite instrumental in Jell-O's early marketing campaigns, at least in terms of hiring the people who came up with them. But after the company sold in the 20s, no.
You write, teaching women, it turns out, was a tenet of Jell-O's marketing. Jell-O, so pliable, so good, teaching them how to mold themselves to match it, pliable and good. Why do you think Jell-O ads reinforced views of womanhood that depicted women as domestic caretakers or made them feel guilty about careers outside of the home?
I just think it was in the air at the time, especially in the 40s and 50s, or mostly in the 1950s, a time when the nuclear family was really emphasized.
And the brand also tried to keep up with changing times over the course of the 20th century. You write about the 1970s Jell-O cookbook that pitched itself to independent women who wanted something healthy. One recipe stood out to me, the Green Goddess Salad Bowl, which I think featured lime, Jell-O, sour cream, and anchovies.
Right. The idea being that the green Jell-O would resemble avocado, which was, you know, it was the 70s, so there was a little bit more of an emphasis on whole foods and nutrition, and also independence for women who were honestly leaving their husbands en masse at that time.
So why was your mother in particular convinced that she was cursed by the Jell-O fortune?
Well, she grew up hearing that. And it seemed to play out, I think, in sort of the lives of her family members. There was a lot of alcoholism and addiction. There were several suicides. And her own mother died quite suddenly and I think traumatically for her. So as a child, I could see her looking around and thinking, oh, yeah, it makes sense that we are cursed. Later in her life, I think she came to see the curse as a more universal force that wasn't specific to the family, but maybe had tight ties to the town of Leroy and to her family.
You assert that the curse was patriarchy. How did that manifest itself in your family?
How didn't it?
Well, there you go.
Well, I think my mother was really concerned with the dark and ominous force that is patriarchy in both of our lives. But, you know, she was still married to my father, and he at times could be a quite overbearing presence. So that was certainly a way in which it played out in my life. And then also, my mother had somewhat of a fraught relationship with her brother that could at times feel like it was influenced by dark patriarchal forces.
Right. About your mother, you write, all she had to do was stay cute, stay pretty, stay silent. What were her aspirations growing up in the 50s and 60s?
My mother was a very dramatic child, which she would readily own and admit to. I think she may have wanted to be an actress. She was always playing roles that were taking her out of her own life. And as an adult, she did do some work in the theater. But that drama was not encouraged in her family or in the town of Leroy, which was small and very interested in sameness and conformity, honestly, which I think were seen as strengths in the town and maybe still are today. But for my mother, who was a different child, you know, that was hard.
Throughout her life, your mother's health complaints were dismissed as, quote, hysterical by doctors. Do you think there's still a tendency by doctors to dismiss women's symptoms and health concerns?
Yes, absolutely.
Didn't this dismissal of symptoms result in a late cancer diagnosis for your mom? And it was tied together, right?
Yeah, it was. Yes, she knew that there was something wrong with her. But doctor after doctor that she went to would just be like, oh, it's probably PMS. And if it's not, maybe it's a food allergy, that sort of thing. And it wasn't until she found a female doctor, actually, who suggested an exploratory surgery that they discovered that she had a pretty severe and late-stage developed cancer in her intestine.
In addition to your mother and grandmother, you also focus on a group of Leroy girls who in 2011 suddenly started twitching, exhibiting Tourette's-like symptoms without any obvious cause. Weren't women in your family also experiencing these symptoms in addition to cancer?
Absolutely. When my mom was a young woman, particularly after the death of her mother, she had almost similar symptoms, which ended up causing her to go to a psychiatric hospital for diagnosis. Later in my life, I experienced similar symptoms. And, you know, in the book, I posit that perhaps the root of those symptoms comes from trauma that doesn't have any other way to exit the body. If we don't speak it, how does it come out?
Mm-hmm. Did the young women ever receive any official diagnosis? I mean, that makes sense to me on some sort of intuitive level, but was there an official diagnosis they received?
Yes. The official diagnosis that they received was conversion disorder and mass psychogenic illness. So conversion disorder is simply the conversion of emotional stress into involuntary physical symptoms, such as ticking or twitching. I think many people are familiar with, you know, migraines, that sort of thing.
Right. But
mass psychogenic illness is definitely a rare condition. It's when symptoms spread between groups of people for no cause, no physical cause. And it's really a mystery. Doctors don't know why it happens, but it does happen. And it happens actually more regularly than we think.
Right.
Yawning, for example. So that was the official diagnosis. Some of the girls accepted it and others did not. As far as I know, they have all healed for the most part.
So how do you reckon with your family's legacy and your inheritance today in your life?
I write about it, I suppose. writing this book has been really helpful to me in terms of clarifying for myself the different threads that always felt like they were pulsing through my life that I knew were connected, but I just couldn't quite verbalize how, and writing this book really helped me to do that.
And how did you go about sort of incorporating the notes that your mother had generated, the writing she generated, but also giving yourself freedom to sort of start at square one?
It was actually a very long and involved process. My mom was a very verbose writer. And she left me hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages with every little detail intact, which was so helpful. But then also it fell to me to sort of weed away what didn't fit in the book and find where the true beating heart of the story was. It took years, honestly. It took a lot of time.
Well, it is a surprisingly complex story. And I congratulate you on completing it.
Thank you so much.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Ali Rowbottom about her new book, Jello Girls, A Family History, published by Little Brown & Company.